When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm your host, Elise Glink, and I'm here to help you make smart choices about your financial life. But first, here's my Glinkonomics report for the week. Home prices rose in April by 6.8% year over year, according to real estate analytics firm CoreLogic, and they've also projected that prices will increase another 5.3% by April of next year, 2016. CoreLogic's chief economist, my friend Frank Nothaf, noted in the report last week that home sales were up by 9% in the first 4 months of 2015, and that's what stoked the price increase. So we're well into June now, and it's going to be a while before we get hard numbers for the start of summer. But these trends should persist, and home sellers should have an easier time selling this summer than they've had in quite a few years, even as we've seen the trend increase over the last year or two. So keep these home prices and home price increases in mind, and let's get on with the rest of today's show. I've got two great interviews from earlier in the year that I pulled out of the archives for this episode because they deal with home values and how home values are determined through the appraisal process. I spoke with Quicken Loans chief economist Bob Walters several months ago about the Quicken Loans Home Price Perception Index for January. And I want to revisit that conversation to remind you how easily homeowners and home appraisers' opinions can actually diverge when it comes to the value of property. At the time, the Quicken HPPI showed that home appraisers were putting a higher value on homes than homeowners were, on average, which was a short-lived trend that has reversed since. Quicken's last HPPI report showed that appraisers were actually valuing homes at about 0.7% lower than homeowners were in April of this year. After my interview with Bob, I'm going to revisit a conversation I had with Jonathan Miller. He's CEO of Miller Samuel Home Appraisers to get a better idea of how home appraisers come to a determination on the value of a property. It's a pretty interesting conversation, and it's a great opportunity for you to get some insight straight from the source. And I've got to tell you, Jonathan is one of the best appraisers out there. I always love talking to him, and I think you'll really benefit from hearing his take on how this whole thing works. Then I want to get away from the topic of home values and talk to you about some of the things you absolutely must know before getting involved in a real estate investment with a friend or relative. And honestly, this applies to any investment, really, that you might ever make. I'm going to wrap up today's show by answering a question on how to protect a real estate investment from a family member. It's never easy dealing with competing family interests, especially when the topic is money. All right, that's this week's lineup, so let's get started. Quicken Loans recently released its Home Price Perception Index, otherwise known as the HPPI. It basically shows the gap between where homeowners think the value of their home is and where an appraiser would see it. So the latest survey from January shows that home value opinions have narrowed a bit. So the difference between where the homeowners think their value is and appraisers think it is actually not as big as it was at other parts of the time during the Great Recession that we just had. Bob Walters is chief economist for Quicken Loans, and I thought that we'd have him on Big Money Real Estate to chat about this and the new realtor numbers that were just released showing that home sales are slowing as we're heading into the biggest season. Bob, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Thanks, Elise.
So let's start with the HPPI. Why do you think that this is an important number to watch?
Well, you know, there's a lot of indices out there that measure the value of homes, but nobody's ever been able to see what is the perception of the homeowner versus the perception of the realtor. That's a really important data point because this process knows that you can think a home is worth $230,000, for example, but if the appraiser thinks it's worth $215,000, you've got a problem. So Quicken Loans is in a unique position that almost anybody else is not, and that is we can capture at time of origination, as soon as the client applies for a home purchase or a home refinance, we can capture what that client thinks their home is worth. Then we send out an independent third-party appraiser. That independent third-party appraiser values the home, and we get another data point. And so when we look at what the client thinks the home is worth and what the appraiser thinks the home is worth, we can see that difference in perception, and that's where we come up with the price perception indice. And it's a really interesting data point that gives a lot of insight as to what's happening in the market as to how different parties perceive home value.
So where do you think the takeaway is for either investors or homeowners or real estate agents? I know you mentioned them as well. Because, you know, real estate agents go in and they typically, a lot of times, unfortunately, will tell the seller, hey, we can get you the biggest number, pie in the sky pricing, when they know in their heads they really can't. But they've got to close that deal. They've got to get them to sign the listing agreement. And then you've got sellers who just get disappointed and they think they know what's going on and they don't. So how does this all come down to value? How does it help people understand where they are versus where the appraisers are?
Right. Well, an index is just that. It's a national look that we also break down regionally to give a broad perception. Now, this doesn't always work for Mr. Smith at 123 Washington Street, but what it lets us know is that is the homeowner's opinion of their home value on par with the appraiser's opinion? So if homeowners think their homes on average are worth more than what appraisers are valuing those homes, you can see that there could be a problem when it comes time for somebody to sell their home or when it comes time for someone to refinance their home. If that indice is coming more in line, then you can see that that perception is back and there's going to be less problems with a home purchase or with a refinance. Again, it doesn't work on everyone's individual transaction, but it's like earnings per share. It gives us a sense of where the market is, or a price to earnings ratio. It gives us a sense where the market is. Does the market think it's overvalued? Do people think are people overvaluing their home, again, relative to appraisers, or are they more in line? So after the Great Recession, or during the Great Recession, we saw that homeowners thought their homes were worth more than appraisers. That was not a surprise. There's some homeowners are just, it takes a while for them to come to grips with what's happening, that home prices are falling. Also, appraisers, that's what they do for a living. So they're in the market watching this happen in real time. Conversely, now over the last couple of years, we've seen that gap narrow. In fact, right now, by a very, very small amount, we actually see appraisers think homes are worth slightly more than the individual homeowners do. Again, I think a lot of realtors would roll their eyes a little bit about that because usually that's out of whack, but it's good news that we're seeing that that gap narrow.
All right, so quickly before we run out of time, I know that the new realtor numbers were released this week showing that home sales are in fact slowing. Here we are, we're in February. This is arguably after Super Bowl Sunday. This is the strongest selling season of the year. Realtor numbers show that sales are slowing. Pending home sales are slowing. What's your take on what's going on?
Yeah, for a monthly number, we saw that there was that drop. I don't give a lot of credence to any given month on a series like that. If you take a look back over time on a monthly basis, they tend to oscillate up and down. What I like to look at is like a six-month trend, and the six-month trend still is pretty good. Nowhere near where any of us would like it, but we're seeing it coming off the bottom from, call it, mid part of last year. So I'm still optimistic to where home sales are. And again, 1 month in a series like that, I don't think anybody should overreact to the upside or downside.
All right. And then just finally, new construction sales, those numbers are still about, I don't know, 50, 60% below where they should be. What's your thinking this year in 2015 for new home sales?
I think it improves, but it improves slowly. We're still going to have to see the entry-level part of the market build. We still need to see household formation has been delayed coming out of the Great Recession. People are delaying getting married. People are delaying gathering those households. But we're starting to see that begin. So why that's important is those are the people that have to buy the homes of the people who are then going to move up or maybe buy a new construction home. So it's all part of that cycle. So I think we slowly get better. We're gonna really have to watch jobs because ultimately that's where it comes from, job growth. And if we get job growth, we'll finally see that start to happen. But so again, positive, but slower than we'd like.
I couldn't agree more. It's all about jobs when it comes to real estate. Bob Walters is chief economist for Quicken Loans. Bob, thank you so much. Will you come back?
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you.
So I wanted to have a more in-depth conversation about the difference between what an appraiser thinks property's worth and what you think your property's worth, and how savvy investors should really be thinking about costs and pricing. Well, I asked my friend Jonathan Miller, who runs Miller Samuels. He's one of the big names in the appraisal world. So, Jonathan, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Great to be here, Elise.
So, let's talk a little bit about what appraisers see when they go into a property. What is it that you're looking at, and how does that help you tell the value?
Well, there, you have to think of the appraisal as being in two really big steps. One is the gathering of information, the actual physical characteristics of the property. You walk in the home, you're looking at anything that you can measure, whether it's square footage, the types of rooms, bedrooms, baths, et cetera, the flow or layout of the house, the size of the land, the general condition. You're essentially, when the appraisal is being completed, you're the eyes of the lender if it's being done for a lender, or for the buyer if it's done for the buyer. And I just want to point out that most people think in a traditional transaction that the appraiser is actually working for the buyer, when in fact they're really working for the bank.
Everybody works for the bank. I mean, except maybe the real estate agent who works for
that's
the seller.
True.
But whatever. Well, that's another show. You can stick around. We'll talk about that next. So, you know, you're looking at all these physical things, and then you go back and you dig out comps, right? What
right.
comparable properties are selling for. Where do you think the disconnect is for people who actually own the property as opposed to you taking a look in? Because people have, you know, homeowners or property owners have underestimated the value by a lot, even more than it was in the Great Recession or housing crisis. And then they're kind of on the other side now, slightly overvaluing. So where does that disconnect come from, do you think?
Well, I think it's a big reason for the disconnect is the difference between the macro view and the sort of local view. And the macro view meaning that they read newspapers, they watch TV, and every month we get a report, whether it's existing home sales or Case-Shiller or new housing starts, and it's sort of the top line headline, and you know, things are going up, things are going down, and they relate it specifically to their home, and yet it has no connection to their home. And I do find during certain periods there's a disconnect where the national news can be more negative than the local news, because there is no national housing market. The local really trumps all.
Except when you're in New York and it's a $100 million condo that sells, right?
Now, so just it's a second home.
Right. It's just a place to park cash, right? Because who's going to give you a mortgage for $99 million?
No,
at
it's a totally
5%.
Cash transaction, right?
So let's just say, and this is because you're in New York, and New York has these insane numbers and these buildings that go up, and it's just amazing to me to think about. You know, do you think that these homeowners who are spending $50 million to $100 million on condos, do you think they think their property is worth more than it actually is? Or is there no amount of money that's too much for a New York condo?
No, there definitely is too much money, too high a price. You can see that with developers getting overzealous about pricing. You do have to remember that about 60% of the condo transactions in New York, and that's all condos, are cash. So there isn't a third party like an appraiser that's involved in it. But remember, they're buying really what's drawing this phenomenon, whether it's New York or any national city, international type city like New York, is they're looking to invest for capital preservation. They're just trying to hold on to what they have. They're looking at the long view rather than the short view, which is far different than we had during the last housing boom a decade ago, where it was very short-term oriented.
Well, if you're in Russia and, you know, the ruble has collapsed in value, but you took your $100 million and you bought a condo in New York, it's probably still worth $100, maybe it's worth $115 million by now, and your ruble would be worth a lot less, just as an example.
That's a very accurate example. We have a lot of that sort of thing going on. Essentially, you're hedging your bets about with against local problems and trying to get your money out. The Chinese are very active in New York for the very same reason. They're worried about a housing bubble. They want to diversify. So we're seeing a lot of that sort of behavior, long-term orientation, capital preservation with real estate investment.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So, Jonathan, I want to talk to you a little bit more about sort of the structural changes in appraisers that the appraisal industry has gone through and how appraisers are feeling about that and how homeowners and other property buyers are reacting. So let's dig in a little bit, because what happened in the leading up to the housing crisis is that I think that many appraisers felt like they just had to turn in the kind of valuations that the banks were expecting, the real estate agents were expecting, and the home buyers and sellers were expecting. And so instead of being the third party, I'm off to the side, and independent kind of rah-rah guys, they became really sucked into this whole thing, which turned into just an escalating vortex of home value. And we know how that turned out. So fill us in on what some of the structural changes that were imposed on the industry after the housing crisis hit that I think are going to have some profound changes going forward.
Yeah, you've said it beautifully. That's exactly what happened during the last housing boom. About two-thirds of residential mortgage origination actually went through mortgage brokers rather than the lenders directly. And mortgage brokers are only paid for their commission once the deal closes, and they got to pick the appraiser. So guess what type of appraiser they would pick and basically enable them to grow, you know, become huge firms, those that would hit the number or, you know, make deals work magically. We called essentially the appraisal profession during the boom. A large percentage of the profession became what I call deal enablers. They were not appraisers. So fast forward to after the financial crisis, we had laws that came to effect now that have morphed into what is now Dodd-Frank, which essentially puts a middleman in between the appraiser and the bank. So the middleman essentially takes the appraisal fee that the consumer pays to the bank. They take half and the appraiser takes half.
And that's not a lot of money. Let's just be really clear. Like, you're paying maybe $300-$400.
Right.
And they're taking half, which means that the appraiser who might have gotten $350 before is now maybe getting what, like $200?
Right. And
how are they supposed to do that?
Well, so essentially what happens is the good appraisers, the ones that are actually appraising, move on to other things. My firm, we've since the financial crisis, we've been doing very well because we moved largely away from bank work, which 90% of bank work involves AMCs or appraisal management companies, these sort of third party middle management groups. So you can imagine that, you know, the quality on an average, there certainly are good appraisers that work for AMCs, but the vast majority are essentially form fillers.
Right.
And they're not in sync with the market. They're working for 50 cents on the dollar. It's a bad situation.
When people are coming in from far away, right? I'm in Chicago. People are coming, you know, from 100 miles away, 60 miles away. In Atlanta, they're coming from 50, 60 miles away. No idea whatsoever about what is going on in the local markets. And then they, you know, the old people who were there for 20 years who have that kind of historical knowledge, they disappear. These new people are coming in and they think that just with Zillow, I guess, or maybe the MLS, they're going to have a sense of, you know, really what the data means. It just seems impossible to me.
Well, it is impossible and it's not reasonable. It's sort of an accident waiting to happen. The big phrase within the regulatory community is local market knowledge, that a valuation expert should possess local market knowledge to perform an appraisal for a financial institution or, in many cases, the appraisal management company, which is the middleman. And that simply, in the structure we have today, doesn't really exist uniformly. There certainly are good appraisers out there, but they're the vast minority of the overall appraisers simply because they have to agree to work at 50 cents on the dollar. In many cases, they're not from the local area. So they're essentially what I call form fillers. And To me, that doesn't provide a reasonable benchmark to make an informed lending decision or a purchase decision by a consumer.
What's the big mistake that could happen? How could this all blow up, do you think?
Well, I think the same thing happens. What you have, the problem with the system now is that because you don't have local market knowledge, you don't have expertise that reacts to changes in the market. It'll work fine if the market is flat forever, but we all know that prices can turn quickly up or down. You need somebody that has their finger on the pulse of the market.
Yeah, it's really hard. Appraisers have always been the leading edge, and yet not so much anymore. So,
right.
Okay, well, Jonathan, wealth of information. Thank you. Everybody should follow Jonathan on Twitter. We're going to put up his, I'm sure his Twitter Twitter follow button has already been up on the show. But follow Jonathan. He's got great insights on appraisals and the appraisal industry and the housing industry in general. So thank you again for sticking around and being with me on Big Money Real Estate.
Oh, my pleasure, Elise. Always fun to chat with you.
If you invest in real estate with friends or relatives, you've got to plan ahead. Otherwise, you could find yourself with all kinds of problems when money is short or disagreements arise. So when you purchase with a friend or relative and you help them do it, you can do it in one of two ways. You can either give them money towards the cash, the overall amount of cash that they're going to need to buy this home, or you and they can sign the documents that are needed to buy the home together. So giving money to them, right, actually giving a gift, is going to be the easier way of doing it. The gift of cash, if it's within a few months of the date of the loan application for the purchase of the property, the lender or broker may require you to provide them with a gift letter indicating that you are indeed gifting the money to these friends and relatives, and it provides some evidence from you that the money you've given them has been in your bank account for some time and does not need to be repaid by them. And that's a pretty important part. If you meet those requirements, you're pretty much done with the gift of cash, and then there are no future worries if something bad happens with your friend or relative's finances or with the home itself, or somebody stops paying, somebody loses a job. None of that's going to come back on you. If you help them with a loan application, this is a much bigger step because you're not only signing the documents with them, but you're becoming personally liable, right, along with them, to repay the full debt that they've taken on in the purchase of the home. And let me state that again. When you co-sign a mortgage, you are legally now responsible for repaying the whole debt, not half the debt, not any portion of the debt, not just if something maybe happens someday, the whole thing. The minute they stop paying, the lender is going to come after you. Likewise, if you decide to invest in the purchase of a home and actually sign the documents, you become personally liable for that purchase, financially responsible for all the costs involved in the purchase of the home, the upkeep of the home, the taxes of the home, and everything that has to do with that property until the property is sold down the line. So let's be clear. If your friend fails to make a payment on time, misses making a payment, or stops making all payments, and you have co-signed that loan, you are in for a major rude awakening as your credit history and credit score are going to take a big hit. Right? Because it's as if you didn't pay those bills on time. Remember, when you get involved in a legally binding transaction with someone, and I don't care if it's a friend, a relative, a stranger, for any of those aspiring married at first sight contestants, your financial fate is tied to that other person's financial situation. Your relative, friend, partner's actions will directly affect your credit. And when their credit suffers, so will yours, especially if they just disappear and you don't even know that they're missing payments. A few weeks ago, I spent some time going over the reasons why you might or might not want to use an LLC. That's a limited liability company, and a lot of times investors use it as a way of owning investment property. So there's some pluses and minuses there. This week, I want to answer a question from a couple who's planning to give their engaged son a house before he gets married. Awfully nice. Wish those were my parents. They established an LLC with themselves and their son as owners, and then they filed a quitclaim deed from themselves to the LLC so that they all own the house and are protected under the corporate veil with rights of survivorship so should something happen. The secondary goal is to protect the house in case their son's marriage doesn't work out. I don't know what they're thinking about the intended here. So they wanted to know if they have thought through all possible scenarios, given those goals, and whether they've done this the right way so there won't be any unforeseen consequences in the future. And here's what I told them. An LLC is usually the best estate planning tool for co-owners to jointly own a home and have title passed to the co-owners after the death. In effect, all membership shares in the LLC would have to be jointly owned with rights of survivorship. Financing a house inside the LLC, on the other hand, might be a nightmare with most, if not all, conventional mortgage lenders. And you may lose tax benefits normally available to individual homeowners who use the home as a primary residence and keep title in their name. And you may also find that owning the membership shares jointly becomes a headache for federal or state income tax returns. So while you might all be considered equal owners in the LLC, you will have additional annual costs and fees associated with tax returns and filing fees that you wouldn't have had if you all owned the homes in your own name. So there might be protections of the limited liability company if something happens to the home, but you have to have homeowners insurance to protect yourself from those kinds of uncertainties, right? That's if somebody trips on the stairs. Now, if your son decides to move out years from now and then you decide to rent the property, having the LLC might prove useful, especially if you have other rental properties. But there's another layer to what's going on here, right? That is, and I referenced it earlier, how these parents feel about the intended. And you can call them helicopter parents, but when you're talking about money, you really have to think out what might happen. And this goes if it's just you marrying somebody, right, and you're sort of combining your assets together, or if you're buying somebody and you're not married, right, whether it's single sex or male-female partners, whether you're in a relationship or not, you have to think about what happens when that relationship ends and how it ends, right, because it's different if your partner dies versus you guys get a divorce or split, and it's nasty, and there's a whole other family that comes in. So here's what I told this family on that front. When you try to protect your assets from your son's new wife, right, this is a reasonable if delicate goal, but it goes way beyond, and you may want to talk to an estate planner and go over the options. Frequently, a trust is another way, and maybe in this case even a better option, for you to own this property. And a benefit of some of these trusts is that they may not require you to pay annual fees to the state in which you live. The trust may be invisible for income tax purposes, and there could be a different level of control that'll be set up. And some of this speaks to how grown up your son is and what the relationship looks like. So an estate planner or estate attorney can help you go over this situation and see if there's a better way for all of you to hold title and can help you imagine all of the different options that could happen over time. And you'll need to do this anyway if your son and his new wife plan to live in the house at some point in time and not just rent it out. If you plan to live in the house someday, the LLC may wind up being a fine option for you to keep the property out of your son's future wife's hands. Double check with local counsel and a tax advisor to be sure. Most importantly, you've got to help your son understand what your concerns are and what he's getting himself into. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and as always, I want to send out a big thank you to all of my guests. If there was anything you missed, don't worry. You can find the show notes to this episode at thinkglink.com. That's thinkglink.com. I want to make sure that if this is the first time you're hearing the show, that you're sure to subscribe to the iTunes channel. If you're a regular listener and you haven't already done so, would you please consider giving the show a rating or review it in iTunes for me? You can do that by searching for The Elyse Glink Show in the podcast section of iTunes. And of course, this helps the show get discovered by new people. And this brings us to the end of another episode of The Elyse Glink Show. I'm your host, Elyse Glink. I'll be back with a new episode next week. I promise. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, everybody.